Please go ahead. The recording has begun.
Thank you, Tim. Ray, would you like a quick roll call?
Yes, please.
Good morning, good afternoon. On today's call, we have Ray Fafford, Robin Gross, Wolf Corbin. From staff, we have Rob Hogarth, Julie Headland, Glenn de Saint-Géry, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. Thank you.
Okay, so this is Ray Fassett. Thanks for joining. As a agenda for today, I think it's pretty clear we are at the what I consider the final stages of the draft ROP. We've had the documents circulated recently based on our call last week. We asked for OSC Council feedback. We've received that feedback. In addition, we've received feedback from ICANN staff council, primarily, which is, I think, a good thing. And our objective today, working under the timelines that we are all aware of, our objective today is to finalize as a work team the draft ROP so that we can communicate this to the OSC, who will, well, in effect, what we're going to do today is send the what we consider as the draft ROP approved by the work team to the GNSO Council. That's in effect what we're going to do today. For the GNSO Council, we'll then take a vote next, I believe on the 24th of September, we're going to take a vote to then take it out for public comment. Okay, so they're not necessarily going to vote that they approve of the procedures. They're going to vote to take it out for public comment. Where, in essence, from what I understand, it's actually going to be the new council members that are seated in Seoul that will vote to approve, formally approve the procedures. And the significance of that is that and then that is when the ICANN board will take action on also approving it based on the recommendation of the new council in Seoul. So that's kind of the logistics of where we're at and what we're doing. So it's important today that we take the feedback that we've received as we requested, incorporate the edits that we as a work team believe should be accepted, and move it on, if you will. So with that said, I don't want to make this too confusing, but I think we have two documents that we're working with today. We're working with a Chuck Gomes edited version that was sent to the list, and we're working with a ICANN legal counsel document that also has edits in it. Wolf, do you have, since Wolf and I are the two on this call today that are on the work team, I think Robin, are you there?
Yes.
Yes, I'm here.
Great.
Ray, well, it's Wolf speaking. So I do have those two documents. I wonder where the comments which came from Steve Metellus have been reflected.
Okay, so I think, you know, again, working under the time frames that we are, Chuck Gomes, chair of the OSC, digested those comments from Steve. He's had some knowledge on some of the issues that Steve raised based on discussions we've had back and forth up till now. He was able to answer some of those, which, again, it was sent to the list in email where Chuck was able to provide some exploratory comment, and where in other areas, Chuck took some of Steve's suggestions and actually edited them into a version of the document. So some were edited in, some were provided explanatory response and not necessarily edited in. What we can do is do the exact same thing. You know, look at Steve's comments, put in what we feel we put in, look at how Chuck chose to interpret those and edit it in, accept the way Chuck has done it. So that's how that is being handled. Does that answer the question?
Yes, sir. I only would be sure that Steve Mandela's comments have already been taken here and are part of the both documents which we are just.
Right. So what Chuck did was provide the edited version, his edited version to Steve's comments. Obviously, Steve was CC'd on that, which I forwarded to the list, this thread, if you will. Now, what did not happen is Steve come back and say, Chuck, I don't agree with how you interpreted this. I don't agree with, you didn't put this part in that I was talking about. So I'm going to take that as an affirmation that Steve's okay with how Chuck went about this.
Now,
okay. Okay, so I think as in terms of efficiency today, I think my view in this is let's go ahead and look at Chuck's edits to Steve's comments, see if we agree with it as a work team where, you know, where applicable.
Okay.
And you know, do approach it that way procedurally. And then similarly with the comments we received back from ICANN Council, go into that document and see if their edits, and they have a couple questions in there too that I think we should discuss and provide response to as well.
Yeah.
And basically attack it this way towards a final version that is likely going to incorporate these two documents. Hello, Julie. Are you listening? Good luck with that. Okay, so so it's going to be a little challenging, but I think we can do it. Okay, so my approach here is that we got to pick one of the two. I'm thinking let's go ahead and start with Chuck's edited version and start there, go through it, see what he's done with Steve's comments, and see if we like it.
Okay.
Okay, so I believe I have that one open. And if we all have that one open, I believe his first comment comes in section 4.1B.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so now I'll try and dovetail between the two, because this was also one the council brought up, so maybe we can kill two birds with one stone here. So what we say here is each house will be allowed one candidate for GNSO council chair.
Ray, this is Rob.
Hey, Rob, yes?
I just wanted to confirm that everybody's looking at the same document.
Sure.
You know, the latest document I thought that I had seen was from Chuck with his changes as of 12:55 on yesterday afternoon. Is that the one you're operating from, or is there...
Yeah, mine heading says, yeah, I believe that is the one I am looking at. Final draft clean with Gomes edits, 15... September 09.
Right.
Okay.
Just as Julie Hedlund, so the first change that we will be looking at would be under 3.5 quorum, Chuck G.
Oh, yeah.
1909, 12:55 p.m.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I missed that one. Okay. Yeah, let's go there. Okay. Thank you, Julie. Okay. All right. So... the question that Steve put forth here is, you know, do you need to have a quorum to initiate a meeting? And we talked about this as a work team. I think back and forth on this. Is why are we doing that? Why are we saying that there needs to be a quorum in order to initiate a meeting? Do we recall? I honestly don't recollect. I know we discussed this, and we felt it was important, and I believe I think Ron had some comments on this, but I honestly just don't recall. Why did we make that a requirement? So that I can respond why it's there. Because Chuck deleted it, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Chuck deleted that sentence out. Go ahead. Yes, go ahead. Thanks, Wolf.
Yes, I saw that, but I read it, so I'm just reading that right now, the Chuck's version, would be for me okay. I was rethinking what was discussed, but I don't remember. So why we did do that? So maybe Ron really had arguments, but I don't recall that as well.
Ray, this is Julie. May I make a comment?
Yes, please.
I think that language was actually there from the original. I don't have the original pulled up, but I think we were saying, yes, that's okay, and we didn't delete it. I don't recall any adamant arguments that in our discussions that there should be a quorum to initiate a meeting.
Well, you know what? I'm this very rarely, Julie. I'm gonna disagree with that. I really don't think that is original language. I could be wrong.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
please disagree with me because I don't have the original in front of me. As I
mentioned, you know, I really do that. I think there was. I think there was a reason why we said why we wanted a quorum. I just it's escaping me as to what that is. So the, but as we sit here today with those of us on the work team call, I've just heard one person say that, you know, what they're reading here as Chuck modified it, it seems to make sense. I don't disagree. And we have Robin on the call. Is there, if there's no voice of objection here, I'm okay with the way Chuck has edited this.
Ray, it's Ken. I can live with it too.
Welcome, Ken. Thank you very much for that. Okay.
This is Rob Hogarth. I'm not inserting an objection here, but just as an observation from what I recall from your discussions in Mexico City, I believe it was. And when this item first came up, and there I believe the issue was the concern that meetings not be held by a minority group. In other words, there was a general sense of fairness that it wasn't appropriate for meetings or discussions to take place without there being a certain level or number of participants and representatives from the various stakeholder groups. So that, I think, was the reason for the discussion and debate about the quorum issue itself.
Yeah, I think that's really the logical reason that I can determine some issue of fairness as it pertains to who's on the call when.
The most speaking, I was just looking to my notices here from the. Sydney meeting, which I was on a call here, and there was something really, so there were arguments, so how could we ensure a minimum of participants?
Well, let's look at that in the context, okay? So really what our role as a work team is to you know, vet this stuff out, prepare what we prepare, and then, you know, it's OSC is very material to our work. They approve what we're approving. So what we're I think doing correctly here is we're getting now the feedback from the OSC as to what they like to see, and that's part of the process here that I think we have to appreciate. So I'm okay with that. So while we may not have full representation of our work team on this call, and we're making an edit here that we know there was discussion about, we can't quite put our finger on. Really, what's overriding it to me is, hey, we're hearing from the OSC what they're going to approve. Unless we have some sort of objection, let's go ahead and use the process as it is intended.
Ray, Rob Hogarth, once again, I know you're not looking at both documents in tandem, both the general counsel's comments and Chuck/Steve.
We can.
I've got them up side by side on my screen, and the only reason I raise that is that the general counsel's office did have a comment on this section, and so I thought it might be appropriate to consider that as part of this discussion.
And you know what, Rob? Now that you mention it, I thought that might even be more efficient. You know, as we go look in each section here, where there's an edit, let's look at the other one at the same time. Instead of doubling back, actually, that might be more efficient. So. That's a good comment. So let's go look at the let's open up where I did the legal counsel opinion. What are they saying here?
Chairman Ron Andruff on board. I apologize for being late to the call. I've been here for a few minutes. Just want to let you know I'm here.
Oh, too late. You can't join now.
Then I'll have to be on my way.
All right, Ron. Welcome aboard. Glad you can make it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So what's the counsel saying here?
I'm sorry. The question was: is this the one that Julie sent? GNSO Council Operating Procedures Review. Rob Hogarth shared with ICANN legal staff. Is that the one that you're looking at?
Ron, this is Julie. The file should read. It should have the at the end of it in parens SE edits.
Yes, thank you. I'm on that page.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can someone interpret for me what it is the issue here that probably Samantha has brought forward?
I think what Samantha's observing is that the standard as currently drafted, she's flagging for your consideration that the quorum definition here doesn't require a majority of each house, and that may or may not be of significance to you guys. But what that leads her to conclude is that there could be a meeting that would be held and a vote couldn't take place. I didn't view her comment as one that said, oh, you need to change this, but just to note that as she interpreted it, you could conduct a meeting, and you wouldn't be able to, the council itself wouldn't be able to conduct the vote.
I think that is the intention, right? We can
conduct
the meeting.
Yeah, but she says at the end that this needs to be worked through. And we haven't had the benefit of talking with her real time about these edits, Julie, in the interest of getting you guys to be able to see these comments circulated it prior to our being able to meet with Sam. But I think it's a reflection that she just says, gee, you know, this could be an area that you guys have some concern about. But I think you guys have actually discussed this in the past, recognizing that at least when it was originally drafted prior to Chuck's edits, the thought was, let's make sure that there's fairness. We're not going to have a meeting if we don't have a quorum, which is at least, you know, a majority of voting members, including one person from each stakeholder group. And then there's that final sentence, which essentially says, you know, we aren't going to take a vote unless there's a quorum.
I'm sorry you got cut off. We're not going to take a vote unless what?
Unless there's a quorum. I think that's essentially what you guys intended on the last sentence, which says whenever a vote is taken, there must be a quorum. My own staff observation on that would be that you might want to say whenever a vote is initiated, there must be a quorum, but I think that was certainly your intent there.
Okay.
Rob, this is Ray, this is Julie. May I make a comment?
Yeah, please.
Or a question, really. Ray, from your experience with the GNSO council meetings, isn't there now a requirement to have a quorum when a vote is initiated?
Yes.
Well, wait a minute. Let's take a step back there. I'm going to use an example, and it's only an example. It does not reflect any position. Okay. Here's a situation that occurred in the past when I was on the council, and there would be some concern about whether or not this could be manipulated in such a way so a vote could never be taken. A few years back, there was a vote that was taken to recommend to the ICANN board that term limits be put in place. There was vociferous opposition from three of the constituencies on this point, to the point that they refused to vote. And what I'm afraid of is if you have a situation in the future, and please correct me if I'm wrong and if I'm way off base, let me know, where there is an intense desire not to move forward with a vote like this. Every time a vote came up, these people could leave the meeting, thereby rendering it without a quorum, thereby, in effect, making it impossible to ever vote on a specific issue because people would purposely leave the meeting so it would become inquired or whatever the word is. So we just need to look at the ramifications of something like this. I hope you all understand that if I'm speaking out of turn, please, I apologize.
No, I think what you articulated, Ken, there is when if the subject matter of whatever is being voted on happens to impact the GNSO counselors directly, there's going to be motivation to use the rules in a way that prevents the vote. So, I mean, that's a very clear-cut example. There could be other examples of how this particular threshold that we're requiring could be manipulated. You know, I think with this said, I think my recommendation here for discussion is to go ahead and accept Chuck's edit and insert the word initiated. Whenever a vote is initiated, there must be a quorum.
So, in effect, what will happen is that needs to be coded into the voting procedure so that before the vote commences, the chair needs to formally ascertain whether a quorum is in effect before the vote even commences. And also, how do you deal with absentee votes in terms of something like this?
This is Rob. Glenn may be able to answer that question, at least with how it's currently conducted.
Sorry, did Glenn?
Yes, ma'am. It was just Ken had made the observation that there are many opportunities to potentially game some of these systems, and I thought it would be useful for you to just briefly share, without completely taking us down a different tangent, Ray, just for Glenn to share with us sort of what the process is now for initiating a vote or for taking a vote. Does the chair, Glenn, confirm once again that there's a quorum and then you conduct the vote? I know she does that at the beginning of the meeting to confirm whether there is a quorum.
Indeed, Rob, when there is the slightest question about there not being a quorum, and I can see on the screen, for example, if people have fallen off, I tell the chair, if she's not aware of it, that there is no longer quorum or that there is quorum.
Well, here's
so we do that before a vote.
Yeah, so here's a way to word it. We could say, whenever a vote is initiated, the chair will ensure a quorum is present.
Yes. Then the other thing I'd like to say is that I completely agree with Ken, and without going into the details, I know of another example that Ken does too, where a vote can be completely distorted because people fall off the call.
Hello?
Hello?
Okay, I'm still here. Everybody still here?
Yep.
I thought I heard a disconnection. Okay. Well, you know, if we go down the path now of unwinding this quorum threshold, then the opposite effect of that is you start having, you know, unrepresentative calls taking place, calling for potential voting that, you know, could become unwieldy. So there's a downside. If you remove the quorum requirement, there's another downside to that. Now it can be used a different way, manipulated in a different way. You know, two people are on the call and they're calling for voting actions. So,
this is Rob. I think, without belaboring this point too much, I think that fundamentally, the way you have all approached this and the way folks tend to behave on the council is assuming good faith. And there's a certain point at which you can perhaps find yourself over-engineering the process. I'm not suggesting we're at one end of that spectrum mm-hmm. or the other right now.
Right.
But at a certain point, you almost have to, you know, understand that, yes, if somebody has a really, truly evil intent, they can find a loophole in just about anything. And it's just a matter of you guys determining how detailed you want to get on some of this.
Yeah. So here's my recommendation. From what I'm hearing, I'm okay with going ahead and accepting Chuck's edit that a discussion can take place even though there's not a quorum. But I would modify that last sentence where it says I would rephrase it as, whenever a vote is initiated, the chair will ensure that a quorum is present. And, you know, and we land on that side of the fence. Anybody object to that?
No objection from me.
No objection.
Okay. Julie, did you capture that okay?
Yes, Ray, I did, and I've made the change. And I am preparing a version dated today where I'm indicating these changes as I go, so it should be fairly quick to prepare the final version when we're completing with the call.
Ray, this is Ken again. I apologize. For some reason, in the middle of our conversation there, I got knocked off the call.
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
I just want to pick up one thing, and you may have gone way past it already. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about initiating a vote and ascertaining that a quorum exists. How do we deal with a situation, and I just have to be frank, and this happens more often than you would imagine. Let's suppose the Names Council call scheduled for what's the normal length now, Gwen? 2 hours, hour and a half, something like that?
In 2 hours.
All right. We get that, and this happens more often than you would realize it. Let's say you're almost at the 2 hours, and you have two or three open issues, and you have to get off the call. And let's say there were votes that needed to be taken, okay, but those votes are now going to be taken after the call would normally have ended. Now, I'm wondering whether or not there should be a process in place that would allow me, hypothetically, to pick up the phone or email Glenn and say, Glenn, I've got to leave the call, but when this vote comes up, I want to cast my vote this way. Now, here's the problem. If the vote actually comes up and can be initiated, Glenn would say to me, Ken, there's no problem. We can do, we're going to, if you're not here, we'll probably do the balance by mail. You'll be able to cast your vote by email. But if I'm not on the call technically at the time that the vote is initiated, technically there's not a quorum. And yet I had every intent to vote. And do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
And Glenn will tell you, this is not an unusual circumstance.
Understood.
Names Council meetings go over all the time.
Understood.
And if not, then you force the Names Council, in order to meet that requirement, into scheduling all of the votes early on inside the two-hour deal to ensure that a quorum will be there for that vote.
Right. Okay. So you've hit on a couple of really touchy issues there, or complicated issues. And one of them was email. You know, so I'll email my vote to Glenn, or I'll email my vote later to the list. And the issue there is we are really confined on how we can use email in a voting procedure by the bylaws. And to complicate matters further, what we've decided to do on last week's call is we agree that there is a need. We believe there is a practical need by the GNSO Council to be able to use email in a way to voice an opinion or otherwise vote, okay, which is really what a vote is, right? So, but we've decided to defer that because that's going to be a touchy discussion. How do we interwove the ability, practically speaking, to do this in a manner that doesn't conflict with the bylaws and how it interprets what absentee voting is, which it includes electronic voting or email voting as one mechanism to do absentee voting, but where only in these specific instances, there are like four instances, I think we outline them later. So I'm suggesting here for today that, yes, you are correct, Ken, in a practical sense, but in order to seat the council in Seoul, I think we're okay with where we can give this as in terms of a status as of now, but we know that we have to look at this concept of email voting.
Yeah, okay, fine with that. Then we just have to do some fine-tuning. I'm going to use other examples that can create some very embarrassing situations in the future if we don't deal with it. We need to make certain. This is a global forum that we're operating in,
right.
And I think of my friend in Cambodia, Norbert, on a regular basis. There is a possibility that could exist that telecommunications may go down, and yet they may have email. So Norbert sends an email to Glenn saying that he's unable to get back into a call, but that he wants to vote on an issue, and he wants this vote to be cast in such a specific way. We need to have a process that recognizes that telecommunications are not as efficient and as effective in all parts of the world as we move forward with this. So
right. We
can push it off now, but we can't push it off forever.
Exactly. We're going to need direction from the new council.
Right.
I mean, to help us prioritize this working group.
There's a very simple way of doing that, and I won't get into it in depth now, but basically every council member could be assigned a specific identity code that they could use in an email to Glenn that would sufficiently identify to Glenn that this person is, in fact, acting in this capacity and would allow her in the future to be able to do some things that could be outlined future. I don't want to take any more time now, but there are ways of dealing with it.
No, that's a great authentication is absolutely a key aspect to absentee and email voting, et cetera. But, yeah, and something, too, that I want to point out and I want to discuss at the end of our call, but I can move it up a little bit, which is, you know, what do we do after we extend this off to the council today? What's our next call? What's our agenda item going to be out? There's nothing stopping us from jumping right in to the email section again and coming up with these procedures. We're just saying as of today and in order to meet certain deadlines, don't count on these two sections being proxy voting and email voting to be completed by SOL. We're just being clear and upfront about that. That doesn't stop us from continuing to work on it, though.
Well, I think that's exactly what you need to say.
Good.
We're going as fast as we possibly can within the bounds of our mandates,
right,
trying to make sure that everything is done in a deliberate and equitable manner. And
right,
in order for us to give you the deliverable that you needed today, we've
right,
accomplished this, but the following areas, don't just tell them we're working on it. It will be available, but we don't
yeah,
want to give you a half a loaf.
Yeah.
On any of these issues, we want to make sure that it's
right,
deliberated properly and dealt
yep,
with.
Yep, and for the record, those types of footnotes are contained in the document, and also in discussion with the OSC, this has been made clear to them, and they are completely on board with us in this regard. So I think we're all saying the same thing. We're in good stead.
Right.
Fair? Yeah, Julie?
Julie, mm-hmm, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Where do we stand then on the language in 3.5? I have made the change. I think the last change that you recommended was the second sentence would read, whenever a vote is initiated, the GNSO council chair will ensure that a quorum is present. And I've also deleted the very first sentence, which was Chuck's suggested edit.
Yes, I believe that is acceptable for today unless there are objections. Understanding that we have other issues to work with on this as it pertains to electronic voting, et cetera, those sections may, you know, obviously affect this. In order for it to work better, those sections will affect this. But as of today, this is where we're at. Any objections? Okay, good. Thank you, Ken. Those are very practical comments that we need to understand. All right, so again, and following Rob's suggestion, which I think is a good one, we're going to try and work on these two documents in parallel. So I'm going back now to Chuck's document. I'm looking at his next comment, which has to do with 4.1b. So, he highlights that each house will be allowed one candidate for GNSO Council Chair. His comment is each house would be responsible for determining how to nominate a candidate. Now, that drives Steve Metellus's comment, which is, and I think ICANN Council's comment as well. Well, let's look at ICANN Council's comment on this, 4.1b. Okay. Okay, so there, I think if I'm interpreting the Council's comment correctly is, you know, where is the process for nomination by a house? Well, we are actually saying that is up to the House. We're not saying it. We're inadvertently saying that. So Chuck is coming in by I think, saying it. Each House would be responsible for determining how to nominate a candidate. Now, we could add a word.
You need to attribute that candidate, not a candidate, but their respective candidate.
Yeah, or a single candidate.
A single.
Each house would be responsible for determining how to nominate one candidate.
In fact, it should be each house is responsible, not would be. It's this is policy. So each house is responsible.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's an improvement, too. So each house is responsible for determining how to nominate a single candidate.
Ray, this is Rob. Just with a note here, that Chuck's addition there is in fact a comment, not an edit. So
right.
You can play around with it any way you want. I think what you're looking to do is maybe adding an additional sentence. Is that what you're proposing?
Well, actually, I was hoping not to. I was hoping to combine the issue counsel was bringing. Counsel is reading what we say here and asking a question. How does the House nominate? Well, they're asking the question because we're not clear. So now what we are trying to be clear on is each House will be allowed one candidate. So we're trying to be clear on that. And what we need to sharpen up is being clear that each House will decide their one candidate. So the question is, can we combine that those two concepts into one sentence where we say each House would be responsible for determining how to nominate a single candidate? Or do we want to break it up into two sentences? Doesn't matter.
If you add the word there, you don't have to break it up.
Okay. So each House is sorry to pick up on Ron's comment. Each House is responsible for determining how to nominate their candidate, which is different than their candidates, right?
Ray, this is Julie. I think
yeah.
So. Because we're saying each House, we might want to say each House is responsible for determining how to nominate its candidate.
Yeah, right. It's candidate. Right. That's proper grammar. Yeah. Now, that could lead someone to question, though. Well, does that mean that we're only allowed one candidate? Well, I don't know. Let's go back and ask them who drafted this. So maybe we just need to be clear. All right, let's do two sentences. Each House, the current sentence is, each House will be allowed one candidate for GNSO Council Chair, period. Now let's add a new sentence. Each House is responsible for determining how to nominate its candidate. Now we're clear. How's that?
Yeah. Works
okay.
For me.
Okay. All right, so that takes care of Chuck's issue. Is there anything here else on the council side? So I've got that document open now. Does the chair have to be a member of the council?
Yes.
Does the chair have to be a member of the council? Yeah. That goes without... Yes, I looked at that as, of course, that goes without saying. But since somebody has raised the question...
That came, before speaking, because we there's a last sentence, should the chair be elected from outside of the houses? So that could be read as outside of the council, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, you know you're right. what are we intending here?
Well, it's only that we say, okay, there's only one member outside of the houses. It's an NCA.
Well, no, anybody can. A House, I think what we're saying here is a House can nominate anybody, you know. It doesn't have to be an NCA. It could, anybody they feel is qualified, for whatever reason. They don't have to be a member of the House or of the stakeholder group.
Sure.
I think, yeah, so what I'm thinking here is, well, once they're elected the chair, then they're a member of the council, but they don't need to be a member of the council prior to being elected chair.
Oh, is that really the case? So I don't understand it that way.
I don't know. I'm just talking out loud. What do others think?
Sorry, can I say something here, Ray? This is Glenn.
Yes.
I know there was, Ken may remember this too at some stage, there was talk of wanting to know if somebody who was actually not a representative from one of the constituencies or the stakeholder groups could in fact be nominated as member of, as chair of the council. And I think at that stage, there was legal said, well, nowhere in the bylaws does it say that the person has to be a member of the council. That is a representative from one of the stakeholder groups.
Well,
I think that's probably where the question has come in.
Well, okay, so the candidate does not need to be a member of a House or stakeholder group or constituency or whatever. But once elected chair, I'm interpreting this question to be, once they're elected chair, are they a member of the council? Or am I not interpreting the question correctly?
Ray, this is Rob. I think the concern is that no House be able to manipulate the system by nominating someone outside the council, getting them as chair, and then allowing them to vote. I think that was really the intent of your efforts here. You know, whoever it ends up being, if you all agree that it's okay for whoever is ultimately elected not to be a member or a participant of, on the council, that at the very least whoever is named doesn't get a vote, because that would be potentially gaming the system.
Well, Ray, it's Will speaking. So I really am a little bit surprised of that discussion, because I was not aware that this could be the meaning of that paragraph. Well, my understanding was up to now that the chair also should be also the candidate. The chairperson should be a member of the council. So I don't know what was it really the case in the past that this has been open to anybody else who has been nominated by any constituency. I'm really surprised. But if that is the case, okay, I will start again to think over.
Well, it's a good question. So how does it work now? Do you have to be a member of the council to be nominated for chair?
Yes.
So we're not clear on this point.
So I would stay with that.
Well, this is Rob. I think that was just the gist of Sam's comment. It was, well, it's not clear, so you guys need to make sure it is clear.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, so we're saying we're bleeding two different things here, unintentionally. What we're trying to say in spirit is a member of the genocidal council does not need to be a member of a house, right? We all agree on that. But then when it comes to a chair, well, okay, the chair must be an existing council member.
Yeah. But, well, it's worth again asking. So because I understand the election process for the council right now is that there will be representatives from the stakeholder groups. Yeah, isn't it? So at least, and from the houses, so stakeholder groups and houses. So they will appoint members to the council. And then... the question, and then the chair, the chairperson is, well, really, I understand, is elected from through the houses. Yeah, I'm just thinking. So, how it works? Does it mean that the house, the members, the council members of different houses appoint the chair or not?
Well, maybe we just need to clarify it. Maybe I'm making too much out of this. Maybe all we need to do is say that the chair must be a member of the council. Maybe we just need to say that, and then we're done.
That's what we should do. Keep it simple. I agree.
By the way, so I understand the question came up because it was a question about the candidate for the chairperson. Should he be, must he or she be a member of the council or not?
No.
So if you say the chair must be one, okay. After he has been appointed to a chair, then he could be a member of the, or will be a member of the council.
Yeah, exactly. So I think all we need to do to clarify this is say that a chair must be, to be elected chair, you must be a member of the council. And we're done.
Yes, to be elected, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be elected chair. For the candidate to be, the candidate must be a member of council in order to be elected chair.
Yes.
Okay. I think we need to add that. I was reading way too much into this. I apologize. So, any objections?
Ray, just to confirm for Julie's benefit, then the second sentence of 4.1b should be: a candidate for GNSO Council Chair does not need to be a member of a house, but must be a member of the council.
Bingo. That's exactly right. And we're done. And that solves the issue.
Ray, this is Julie. I've noted that. Ray, let me ask a question here, if I may.
Yep.
I have just received an email from Samantha Eisner on the ICANN legal team.
Okay.
I had asked whether or not they had any suggestion for language in the Section 3.5 quorum that might that we might want to consider to avoid the type of issue that we were discussing where someone could, you know, sort of game the system or, you know, prevent a meeting from happening, you know, or a vote from happening if we didn't have a quorum. She did make a suggestion for language, and I don't want to bring us back if we want to move forward, so I'm asking whether or not you might want to hear that. Otherwise,
I'm willing to hear it now because it's still fresh in our mind. So go ahead, let's hear it.
Let me read it for you. So the first sentence then would read, you know, because we are deleting what was the first sentence. So
right.
It says, a quorum is a majority of the voting members of each house and must include at least one member of each stakeholder group. And then she doesn't change that last sentence, which we changed about a quorum,
mm-hmm.
you know, must be initiated, you know, whenever a vote is, you know, when a vote is initiated, et cetera. So the change is that she's just massaged the language a little bit, saying that it's a majority of the voting members of each house and must include at least one member of each stakeholder group. The way it currently reads is
I think you're adding in each house after voting members.
A quorum is a majority of voting members, which includes at least one member of each stakeholder group. So she's making just a very minor change. And in fact,
all right, so go ahead and read the sentence one more time for me.
Let me read it then. A quorum is a majority of the voting members of each house and must include at least one member of each stakeholder group. That, in fact, so I think that's a very, the difference is that we say which includes at least one member of each stakeholder group, and she suggests which must include at least one member of each stakeholder group.
Okay. I'm not sure that addresses the issues we were discussing either way of the fence there, how this could be manipulated. But I think it's crisper. I will say that.
I mean, I think her point was that if we are mandating the, you know, the requirement for a member of a stakeholder group, it's more clear to say must as opposed to
making it crisper. I'll take that. I think it is crisper for what it is we've decided the intent of this to be. Is there any objections to this approach to making it crisper?
This is just Rob. Obviously, I can't enter an objection as a staff member. I would note, though, that I think that's a rather substantial change in that right now you guys, at least in the initial draft, have suggested a simple majority of members. And this is a more stringent requirement, which requires the calculation to take place on a house-by-house basis.
Yeah.
But if you're fine with that, that's okay. I'm just noting that I think it's somewhat substantial in that respect.
Yeah, it's strengthening it. I agree.
Ray, this is Julie. So to Rob's point, is that more restrictive, though,
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is more restrictive. It's strengthening the spirit of what we were saying. And I don't view what Rob has said as an objection. I kind of default to where we were. I was fine with the way we had it with before the input by Samantha, and I'm still fine with it. And it's less complicated. So, you know, I'm just interpreting it as let's keep what we had.
Yeah, Ray, this is Julie, and certainly hers was simply a suggestion. And
exactly.
Up to the
exactly.
Work team to decide.
Yeah.
I will revert to the language that says a quorum is a majority of voting members, which includes at least one member of each stakeholder group.
Yeah. Now, we could say must include at least one member of each stakeholder group. And I'm okay with changing which to must. and must include? If we want to put the word must in instead of which, does it matter? Does anybody feel that's a material difference?
Well, it's Ron. It is a material difference, but I think it's a warranted one. Must include makes more sense.
I agree. That's crisper. So if we can get the word must.
I agree
must
with that, too.
Okay. All right, so let's get the word must in there, okay, in place of which, however it sounds correctly, okay? Do you want to read a sentence back, Julie?
Yes.
Okay.
Just doing that, thank you. Okay, a quorum is a majority of voting members and must include at least one member of each stakeholder group.
Okay.
And the next sentence, just to remind everyone, is whenever a vote is initiated, the GNSO Council Chair will ensure that a quorum is present.
Perfect.
Yes, I like it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay.
Thank
so,
you very much, Ray. I didn't mean to interrupt there, but I don't.
No, it's an improvement. It's an improvement. I think it's better. So that's good. Thank you. And thanks, Samantha, for us. Okay, so we have 4.1. We're back to 4.1B. There are just some minor edits that Samantha also put forward that I don't have an issue with. It might be crisper. You know, it's basically the last sentence, which is, should a chair be elected from outside of the houses? I'm fine with that. Any issues?
No.
Okay, so now trying to stay consistent. Is there anything in the next section by Chuck? No, I don't see anything. Okay, so let's stay with Samantha's version here, where, again, she's putting in some, I don't know, maybe what I call fixing the language. I don't see material changes in what Samantha is bringing forward. I view all of these edits, I believe, while looking at them again, as simply just making it crisper. You know, adding the word nominees after the unsuccessful votes. You know, that kind of goes without saying, but it sounds better when you say it. But I don't see material changes in Romanet 1. Anybody? Okay, so let's go to 2. All right, her question. So Samantha has a question. It's going to be a tie between the two candidates or a tie between candidates and none of the above, correct? If this is a tie based upon the scoring, the raw vote or the percentages in each house?
Ray, this is Julie. May I make a comment?
Yes.
I think what she's asking, I think she understands that in a case of a tie, I mean, she's asking, I think, that it's a tie between the candidates and none of the above, and she's asking, is that correct? And then, because it doesn't say what a tie is, I think she's asking this question because we don't really define the word tie.
Okay, so
we don't define how a tie is determined.
Okay, so if we said in the case of a tie between two candidates, does that clarify what a tie is? A tie has to be between two people.
Well, but she makes the point, or none of the above. The two have to be included. In the case of a tie between two candidates, or between a candidate and none of the above, a second election will be held. But is there a chance for the? Yes, there is a chance for a candidate and a none of the above. That's correct. Yeah.
Look at the new second sentence that Samantha put in. The candidates shall remain the same for the second election. All right, so does that address the issue right there? If we say none of the above is a candidate, I don't know if that's correct or not, but if we assume that none of the above is a candidate, then we're saying outright, in the case of a tie, the candidates shall remain the same for the second election.
Well, again, I think it's important that the definition is there, because if we don't say that none of the above is a candidate, I think it would be inferred if we said in the case of a tie between the two candidates or a tie between the candidate and none of the above, a second election will be held. The candidates shall remain the same in the second election, may not fit with that language because a candidate is not, none of the above is not a candidate. It's just a no vote.
Right. This is Julie. Ray, I want to agree with Ron, and I think that that's maybe what Samantha's getting at. Two things, really. One is to define precisely what the tie is between, which could be two candidates or between a candidate and the number of the above. And then I think she's adding a sentence that says, that makes it clear that it would be the same candidates in, you know, in the election.
Okay. No, I'm okay with that. If that's where we want to be crisp, is defining what a tie means between two candidates or a candidate and none of the above. I'm okay with that. And then I think the second sentence can go away.
In which sentence? The second sentence.
The candidate shall remain the same for the second election.
I think, Ray, this is Julie. I think she's making the point that we're not saying that there couldn't be different candidates for the second election. Do we want to say that the candidates are the same? Because we don't say that there couldn't be new candidates. We just say, in case of a tie between, you know, two candidates, the second election
okay.
is held. But we don't
All
say
right.
whether or not it has to be the same candidates.
Okay. Okay, right. We're inferring that with the third sentence. All right, let's leave it in.
To understand, I think her comments, and she's being very, very specific that we not infer, and so she's adding
yeah.
where
right.
we might be making an inference that someone, it may not be obvious to someone.
I agree. That's what I call crisp. So I'm okay with defining tie, as Ron pointed out, and leaving Samantha's new second sentence in there.
And then do we want to add language that says what is the tie based? Is it based on the percentages in each house, which I think it is, but we don't say that.
A tie is based on a percentage of votes, equal percentage of votes, right?
I'm not making any suggestions. I'm just putting it out there for discussion.
Yeah, I don't want to go, you know, there is a balance here of, you know, trying to script for every scenario or every interpretation. Because I could look at, let's look at the last sentence. It says, an election for the new nominees will be rescheduled for no sooner than 30 days after the unsuccessful vote. Now, what if the House doesn't put forth a new nominee? Then what do we do? You know, so we can keep going on and on and on. You know, it's 'cause an election for the new nominees. Well, what if there isn't a nominee? What if one House doesn't put one forward? Is it then going to be the one that did versus none of the above? And now we're saying none of the above is a nominee. You know, so we can go on and on with this. I think where I'm falling right now is go ahead and expand this number two, defining tie the way Ron suggested, leave the second sentence in. We've not seen any pushback from the OSC people. They've looked at this. They have not flagged this as a big issue. But I do think some of Samantha's comments here are definitely making it crisper. But we have to draw a line somewhere. You know, what does a tie mean? Well, the tie means equal. You know, I don't know. I don't think we have to define that in terms of percentages. That's my feeling. Anybody else have a thought on that? Okay, so I'm okay with accepting the rest of Samantha's edits, too. I think it is that last sentence is crisper, where we say an election for the new nominees will be rescheduled for no sooner than 30 days after the unsuccessful vote, which is consistent with what we, you know, did in number one above. So does anybody have any further comments on this section? Objections? Anything? Are you there?
Here and agree with you.
Okay.
Here and agree.
Okay. Thanks, folks. All right. So moving on to number three, Chuck's document doesn't have anything in there, but Samantha is doing her crisper drafting for us, so let's look at this.
Oh, Ray, can I ask a question real quick?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Julie.
I thought... Okay. Now, no, actually, maybe I think it's already here, but was there... any discussion of some different language that went into some additional description in the area of the score and how the score is determined, or has that been incorporated here?
Yeah,
I'm just not seeing a comment here, and maybe it's been incorporated in Chuck, because I'm reading number three.
Yeah, there's new language here that I sent to the list that Stephanie didn't. Stephanie Van Gelder?
Stefan, actually. It's a guy.
Sorry. All right. Stefan Van Gelder, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Flagged this one as potentially, he understood it, but he wasn't sure that others would understand it, so he thought it could be crisper. So I put forth a potential edit to see if Stefan would. So what his reaction was, he liked it. Chuck came in and said, yeah, okay, that is clear. And I forwarded that to the list. So I don't have it in front of me.
I can pull it up if you'll hold on for a second.
Yeah. Have others seen it? It was on the list. Have others seen the language? Yeah, I think we
I
can
have
just.
It.
Yeah,
have
I think
it.
When we. I think we can. We can replace three.
Yeah.
Entirely with the new language.
Yeah. Let me. Can I read it off?
Yeah. Please go ahead.
Sure. Okay. The leading candidate will be defined as the one with the highest score. The score will be determined by adding together the voting percentages attained from each house. The highest percentage attainable in each house is 100. The maximum score a candidate can achieve is 200 as a result of attaining 100% of the votes from the contracted party house and 100% from the non-contracted party house, and in parens, 100% plus 100% equals score of 200.
That's a mouthful, but it's clear. So the OSC people liked it, so... it's saying the same thing we're already saying. It's just saying it a little more long-winded. Does anybody have any objection of just swapping out what's in three now with what Julie just read?
No objection from me.
Objection.
Okay. Great. Thanks for catching that, Julie. Okay,
sure,
so on into number four. Again, nothing on Chuck, but on Samantha's. Okay, so again, CRISPR in the event that... Now here's a good catch, though. I mean, neither candidate reaches the 60% of each house. That's a good catch. That's important. Threshold and the candidates do not tie. A second runoff ballot will be held between the candidates. Yeah. So other than I think is a good catch on putting in each house. The rest of it to me is just making it crisper and more correct as to what we're trying to say. Does anybody disagree? Okay, so on to number five, same catch, 60% of each house. Again, I think the spirit remains, no substantive changes, and I'm fine with those edits. I think it improves what we're saying. Any disagreement?
No.
Okay. So on the C, what do we have here? Each house shall select a vice chair within its respective house. Yeah, that's proper grammatical. Okay, D, again, just clarifying, I think, what she deleted. And vice chair may not be elected from the same stakeholder group. A chair may not be a member of the same stakeholder group of either. Yeah, I think it's saying the same thing, just differently. Any objection or disagreement? By the way, I do see these edits from Samantha as improving our work, so I'm appreciative of her doing this. I think E, same thing. This is not a material substantive change. I like the edits. Okay, on to G. Again, I don't see material. I don't see substantive change. Just making it clear.
Agreed.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So, hold on. I'm switching back and forth now between documents. It looks like 5.2 notice of meetings is the next one. Nope. Chuck has something in 5.1. All right, so this is back to Steve Metallitz, right? All right, so what I think what Chuck is doing here, he's capturing Steve's comment and incorporating it in here. And again, I'm going to default to the fact that Steve didn't come back and say, sorry, Chuck, no, you did not capture what I meant. He didn't do that. So I'm gonna approach this in a way where it appears to me Steve is okay with Chuck's edits to his comments. Does anybody have a problem with this approach? Okay. So in the first full paragraph, provided that all members participate in this is section 5.1, first full paragraph. Chuck deletes speak to and hear, provided all members participating in such a meeting can communicate with one another. Okay. Okay, he's using the word communicate with instead of speak and hear. And that was in response to an issue that Steve Metallitz brought forward. I don't have any issues with making that edit. Does anybody else? Okay. All right, second full paragraph. I think I see another edit in here that again, is being driven from Steve Metallitz's comments that Chuck is incorporating. Okay, so except where determined by a majority of vote of members of both houses of the GNSO Council present that a closed session is appropriate, in-person meetings shall be open to physical or electronic attendance by all interested persons. I don't see an issue with adding in-person in there. Does anybody see anything substantive by putting that in?
No, I don't see anything substantive, but I just kind of wonder, if, you know, what, I don't understand the logic.
Sure.
Council present that a closed session is appropriate. In-person meetings shall be open to physical or electronic attendance. What's an in-person meeting? A meeting is physical or it's electronic attendance. I mean, you can only have one of the two. I'm not sure what the in-person adds to that sentence. In fact, it kind of causes me to not understand the sentence very well.
In-person meetings shall be open to physical or electronic. In other words, to be able to call in. So the meeting.
What's in-person mean?
Open
to a physical attendance.
Yeah.
In-person
so,
meeting. I must be. You know, when would you? What other type of meeting would one have? Are you saying it's only a conference call?
You know, for example, a meeting of the GNSO Council during an ICANN meeting. So that's an in-person meeting by the council.
But I'm saying, as soon as you start talking about an in-person meeting, then you've got to start talking about a non-physical meeting. So I would just say meetings shall be open to physical or electronic attendance. I agree with the way the sentence is written as it is right now. That's my point.
Yes, okay. So that's what that wants me to do here. Let's go back to, okay, what's Steve saying? All right, this is the second paragraph, correct? Okay. Hold on, bear with me. All right, apparently the issue is the second paragraph, this is Steve Metallitz now, okay, is the second paragraph intended to allow for non-member participation in teleconference meetings. This has generally not been allowed up to now. Shouldn't that be on a listen-only basis, or does this paragraph only apply to face-to-face meetings? And I'm kind of with you, Ron. I'm not sure how Chuck's edit captures the issue that Steve is raising. I think for now I'm kind of looking at Ron's thought process and agreeing that I don't think Chuck Zed is doing anything for us here.
Ray, this is Julie. Can I make a comment?
Yeah, please.
I think Chuck Zed is basically saying that this paragraph does only pertain to face-to-face meetings. I mean, in-person meeting face-to-face. So he's maybe trying to address Steve Metallis's question, suggestion that this paragraph only pertains to face-to-face meetings. And that was the inclusion of in-person. Of course, we can disagree with that, but I think that might be what he was trying to do.
Well, but I mean, the title here, the headline here is Conduct of Council Meetings. So I think meetings should be construed to be whether physical or online meetings.
Right. I agree with you, Ron. I'm just...
Yeah. I know. I appreciate the clarification. Absolutely. So I'm just again presenting my argument that, you know, if this is conduct of council meetings and we're to explain how that's going to happen, I think it's meetings should be more general as opposed to in person.
I agree with that thinking. Anybody have any other thoughts on that? Because I think we don't accept this at this point, and I will respond back to Chuck that the reason we did not is because exactly what Ron just said. This is conduct of council meetings in the general sense. If we start going down the path of conduct of an in-person meeting versus a teleconference, you know, we're branching off again. Not that we shouldn't. We'll let them tell us. The OSC says, or the new Genocidal Council says, you know, we need codes of conduct here for in-person meetings, and we need them for teleconference meetings, and we can do that. But as of now, I think we do not accept this edit, and I'll explain why. Any issues with that?
Okay.
All right, so 5.2, does Samantha have anything there? 5.1, no? Okay, so 5.2, there is one edit each by Chuck and Samantha. Okay, so Steve's question is, why did we change it from 5 days to 8 days? And then we had eight business days. I don't know, what's Steve asking?
Ken, are you still on the call?
Yeah, why the change from 5 business days advanced submission of motions to 8? This could make it even more difficult.
That's why I asked if Ken was on the call, Chairman, because I think that their concern was that this would make, I think Steve's comment was this could make things drag out longer or take longer.
Right.
I wanted to ask Ken what his feeling was as a counselor, but it doesn't sound like he's still on the call with us.
Well, Chuck's solution to the question that Steve raised was changing business days to calendar days. Again, I've not heard pushback or feedback or questioning from Steve on Chuck's proposed change here. So,
let's put in the other. Why don't we do that? That would make some sense. Less than no later than 8 calendar days before the GNSL meeting. That's
okay.
Because we work, 24/7 around the all week long kind of thing on these things. So,
okay.
That makes sense to me.
All right. No objections to that change. I accept it. And then Samantha has a nit here where in the second paragraph of 5.2, adding GNSO before council. That would make sense to me.
Agreed.
Okay. So we're on to 5.3, who may make motions or cast votes. Okay. All right, so Steve, I think, is raising the point of, what are these sentences even for? So Chuck is asking that question. Are these sentences even needed? Now, this is the latter half of the paragraph, first paragraph of 5.3. Well, okay, so let's look at this and see, understand what their purpose is. Try and understand it. Yeah, I guess I could make the case that they're not needed. Does anybody have a feeling strongly as to why they are needed? So we're getting a suggestion from the OSC basically to take these two sentences out because they're just not needed. I don't disagree necessarily. Does anybody have...
Which specific sentences would you mind just to...
Sure, I'll read it. Acts, yeah. Acts by the GNSO council members present at any meeting at which there is a quorum shall be acts of the GNSO council unless otherwise provided herein. And then parens, see section 5.4.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And so they're saying that long sentence has no merit.
Yeah, just saying nothing, right.
Who may make motions or cast votes. That's it. Yeah, so it finishes, that sentence, that paragraph could finish easily with persons who are not council members may not vote, period, end of paragraph. I would use that.
All right. Wolf?
Right.
Okay. Rob?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I seem to recall that this was a specific request by somebody on this team to have that language in there, but I don't recall who that name is.
Well, it was speaking. So we have had some discussion about it because it used to be a sentence in the former bylaws, I think. So and we did not understand because there was a different formulation. So we tried to understand what it meant, and then we were of the opinion, anything which is acted by the members of the council is an act of the and of the council as a whole. So that's the only thing. But if there is nothing to be explained here about it, if that is clear enough, so we don't need it, I think.
Okay.
So it is only it says if there are some people sitting from the council and they are doing some acts, so then they are doing that on behalf of the council. That's what it says. Nothing else.
Okay. My own view is, is that is the spirit of what we're already saying. I don't think we need to say it. Those two sentences are causing more confusion than helping, I think. Anybody have a strong objection to go ahead and removing those two sentences, I guess?
No.
Okay, let's go ahead and do that, Julie, okay?
It's been done. Thank you.
All right, so we have something on, is there anything in Samantha there? 5.3, no. Okay, so next one is Chuck again. We're in 5.4, and by the way, when I do say Chuck, just for the record, it's in response to Steve Mattel's issues he's raised. Okay, so 5.4, Chuck deletes something here. Oh, okay, here we are. This is the issue that speaks to, and we discussed this as a work team, should abstentions be counted as votes against? Obviously, we're getting some strong feeling here from the OSC members that no, it shouldn't, and Steve, I think, even went on to say, gee, I didn't like that way back in the last time we went through this whole thing. Now, where we landed on this, my recollection is that, what does the board do? Do we want to be consistent with the board or not be consistent with the board? That's our choice, and we chose to be consistent with how the board treats abstentions. And there's also the issue, there are gaming issues involved as well, but that was really more secondary. The primary thing we wanted to do here was just remain consistent with the board. If we delete the sentence like we're being asked to do, then we will be inconsistent. The GNSO Council voting procedure will be different than the board. So I'm tossing that issue back out there again, because we've talked about this. What are thoughts? Discussion?
Chair, I'll get in that queue. It's Ron.
Yeah, please, Ron. Go ahead.
I would say that the logic is to keep things consistent within the ICANN process. I thought Chuck responded to Steve's comment relatively clearly. I personally do not like the idea that an abstention is a no vote. So I agree with Steve. But at the same time, I think to start creating different voting mechanisms within the GNSO and the board is fruitless. I don't see the purpose of that. So I think we need to concede the point, while we may not like it, the abstention is a negative vote. We're following the same process that the board is following. And should the board make a change in that regard, so would we at the GNSO level.
Well, I kind of feel the same way with you, Ron. I don't like going down the path of doing inconsistencies. Does Wolf or Robin, Ken, any thoughts on this based on your experiences in the council, or is the council, should it be looked at differently than the board? You know, Steve's point was there is the potential for conflicts of interest at the council level, more opportunity likely for abstentions, you know, than at the board level. If I were to ask him, that's probably what he'd say. So there could be a case as to why it should be different at the council level versus the board level. Does Robin or Ken or Wolf, any strong feelings on this?
It's Wolf speaking. So, I mean, if we remove that, like Chuck is doing, so for me the question, is it true or is it not true? Because it doesn't matter, no, whether it's in or not in this sentence, you know. It only says this has the effect of making an abstention count the same as the vote against. I cannot judge on it. So is it true or not? So we don't make here, we don't say it has to be counted as a vote against, or we only say it has the effect.
Ray, okay. This is Rob.
I
can interject, and I think this we may have discussed this together as a team before as well. This goes more toward the calculation of the final results, I think, particularly of the percentages. Using the very simple example of, you know, 10 counselors ready to cast a vote in a house, for example. If 5 say yes and 5 say no, then you don't have your 60%, right? You only have 50% yes. But if 2 of those counselors choose to abstain and those votes are not counted as votes cast, then you're doing a calculation of 5 out of 8
right.
yes, and so that vote passes. So I think that's what this query ultimately is intended to address. I'm not sure what the effect is. I mean, the bottom line, though, is that an abstention is not a vote cast, and you do make it easier to pass things.
Well, Wolf is making a point. He's saying, okay, so let's read that last sentence. Abstentions count as votes cast. So in the scenario example you just said, Rob, it would still be 10.
It would count as a no vote. That's right. It would count as a no vote.
So he didn't change it. Yeah, so Chuck didn't change it, you know, right? So Steve raises the concern that abstentions should not be counted as votes against. Chuck offers a deletion but doesn't change the result. It still would be...
That's correct.
Yeah.
Excellent point.
So I guess we got to, you know, leave that up to Steve to come back again. There will be a public comment period. Steve is obviously part of the OSC. If he feels as strongly about it, there's going to be a couple other avenues from here to he can offer some language, whatever it is. So, okay, so now, yeah, who's that?
This is Julie. Yeah, I just wanted to point out that the council will consider this, and so in that sense, Steve will have yet another option to consider. But I agree with you that I think that it's still clear that abstentions count as votes cast, and that Chuck is simply taking out this sentence, which is somewhat extraneous, that then goes on to explain this has the effect of making an abstention count the same as a vote, et cetera. So, but just to point out, yes, this will still have more discussion in the council as well as in the public comment period.
Well, okay, yeah. I mean, the council discussion in the near term is simply going to be, okay, should we take this document out for public comment, these rules of procedure? That's it. They're not going to be discussing the substance of it. They're only going to vote on whether to take it out for public comment. I mean, I suppose they can discuss the substance of it, but they're not going to, to my knowledge of the process here, they're not going to be able to go in and change anything. All they're going to be doing next, the next step, is vote for this document to go out for public comment. And then it's going to be the new council that gets seated. Now, whether Steve is on that or not, that is going to go through each one of these or analyze it and offer edits and changes and whatever it is they want to do in order to vote an approval for it. And then it's at that time it goes to the boards. So the existing council, to my knowledge of the process, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, the existing council members are not going to be editing this. They could vote not to send it out for public comment for whatever reason, I suppose. No one anticipates that. But I don't see edits coming from the council.
That's correct.
That's correct, although, again, this is Rob, I guess there is the possibility for comments to be made at the council meeting and say, oh, let's change this. Certainly is possible. It's not likely or probable, but I don't think there's a prohibition from councilors providing additional input.
Good point. So, yeah, we'll learn as we go. All right, so I guess what I'm saying is we're looking at the part Chuck deleted. I think we're seeing that deletion as an improvement. We're not changing the substance of what it says, even though Steve raised a concern. So, and we're going to go with it.
Yeah.
Anybody have any issues or objections to that?
Okay. No issues, no objections. But unfortunately, Chair, this is Ron. I have to drop off the call. I have a hard stop.
Understood.
Apologize to everyone. Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Thank you, Ron.
Thanks, Ron.
Catch you later. Bye-bye.
Okay, so let's keep moving forward here.
Yes, wait, I have to say, I've left 15 minutes.
All right, we're going to do it. We're going to do it, Wolf.
Okay.
All right, so the next one I see under Chuck's comment, page 8 of 9, is section 7. And by the
now,
way,
Ray,
do you want
to skip back to Sam's comments? Most of them are just small knit edits.
I didn't see anything. Oh, yeah, you're right, 5.6.2. I missed that. Okay. Are you at 5.6.2, Rob? Is that what you see?
Yes. The one just above that, 5.6.1 was just taken out.
Oh, yeah.
So that was, this is Julie, that was a correction. That should have been taken out.
That's
nothing. But I think her point for 5.6.2 was that we mention, we refer to discretion in that last sentence, but discretion goes back, the reference is to a sentence that's a couple sentences back, and I think, she was saying that was sort of a tenuous reference. I mean, we're saying to ensure balance, the chair has discretion to delay an intervention, blah, blah, blah. Then there's another sentence intervening, and then it says, such discretion should not be exercised for a point of information, et cetera. And she's like, well, what discretion are you talking about? And then she was wondering how would a council member seek a point of information? We don't describe that. Do we say they seek a point of information by raising their hand or asking to speak at appropriate gap? Why are they seeking, this, how do they, what's the process, I guess it's should say.
So if we change the first part of the sentence where it starts with such discretion, if we change that to chair discretion to delay an intervention should not be exercised for a point of information, is that what we're trying to say? When we say such discretion, we're saying chair discretion to delay an intervention?
I think that's right.
Okay. Yeah. All right, now what about the rest of this being highlighted? A point of information is for GNSO council members seeking information from a chair. Not intended. Why does she highlight that?
She highlighted it, this is Julie, she highlighted it because she had some questions about how does one go about seeking asking for a point of information. Should we describe that here? Meaning, rather than just saying a point of information and what is a point of information, then do we want to go on to say a GNSO council member raises a point of information by asking to speak in an appropriate gap? A point of information is information to be sought from the GNSO council chair as well as other council members or the secretariat. I mean, who are we asking for information from? Is it from the chair? Is it from other members? Do we want to describe that here or not? I mean, it's up to us, you, I should say.
All right. Well, we sort of open with a description of the process. At a physical meeting, a GNSO council member may raise a hand and wait to be recognized. So I think for some bit of its expediency, I will admit, I think we just go ahead and change that first part that is unclear about such discretion to uh, the chair's
the chair's
discretion to delay an intervention should not be exercised for a point of information.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say the GNSO Council chair's discretion to delay an intervention
should
not be right.
Okay, and then let's keep moving. Any issues with that?
No,
Rolf?
No.
I think it's me and you. Robin, you still there? I know Ken's gone, right? Okay. Does Chuck have anything here in 5.2 or 5.5? All right, so I'm not seeing anything. All right, I don't see anything additional from Chuck until session 7. So let's just keep moving on through Samantha. the next one I have is 5.7, seating. I see those as just improving.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 5.9. Again, same issue now. Response to what? At the very end.
I think there you could just replace response with explanation and make it an explanation.
Mm-hmm. For an explanation.
Ask for an explanation. Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's a good suggestion, Rob. Thank you. Okay, so we've got an or in section 7 for Samantha. No issue to me there. That's in, by the way, 7C. Proper. Oh, it looks like she also has a colon or semicolon after B. So unless that was already there, I can't tell. Okay.
Ray, this is Julie. So Chuck had a comment on the first sentence under 7, GNSO Council absentee voting, if we want to do these concurrently.
Yes, so, Ray, it's Rolf speaking. So I think that's the basic comment. You know, it's really a basic question. So what is it about absentee voting? Is it limited to a number of issues or items, or should it be... to any kind of voting. So that's the basic question here.
That is the basic question. Now, I've become a little confused on this point in that I thought that the bylaws were specifically identifying where absentee voting can be used. Is that true or not true?
Yes, right.
Yeah.
I answered from the discussion with Avri. So from her experience, she was explaining it was limited up to, I think, 3 cases before, because the general council was of the opinion on the level of the bylaws only those cases can apply. That was the answer. So now we move the absentee voting to the level of council of rules of operation. So that may be different from that perspective, I think so. And it could be open to all of to all items, I think. So it could be. My personal opinion is we shouldn't open that because, I think so that would open the council meetings to, let me say, more or less volunteer meetings. Let me say that in that way, and not being obligatory for the members. And I would like to see some obligation for attending members personally.
Yes. So you're creating a motivation to attend, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And if you don't limit that list, so that there's no there wouldn't be a motivation.
Right.
There would be less motivation, I can say.
Yeah. I agree with that. That's good. That's good practical thinking. I'm also in favor of leaving it, you know, specifically defined with these 4 areas. It's consistent with what the bylaws are dictating. I don't get Chuck's second sentence on the comment, though, where he says the GCOT may consider expansion of this. I'm missing something here. The GCOT may consider expansion of the list in their ongoing work. If we expand the list of what can be considered as absentee voting, we're changing the bylaws, and we can't do that. What am I missing? Hey, Rob? You there?
I'm here. I don't have a good answer for you.
It seems like if we try as a work team to expand this, so this is where I guess I'll have to ask Chuck for clarification. In the meantime, I think we leave this section as is.
Well, I could find only one point. if it's something related to, let me say, amendments to the rules of procedure, themselves, you know, what we are talking about. So
okay,
that
could
be a point.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose. But I think we go ahead and leave this. We leave this as is. Are there any objections?
No.
So in this case, I'm going to ask Rob's opinion. Are you okay with what the way this reads now, Rob? I'm asking.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think so.
Okay, let's keep moving. So what does Samantha have for 7? Looks like just minor nits. I don't see anything there, and I'm okay with accepting those nits. I don't see anything further on Chuck's document that we need to discuss. Assuming Julia's been able to capture everything we've been doing along the way, we're in pretty good shape now in that we have one document again.
Right. Ray, can I just point out something
yes.
That Samantha had noted? I don't – it's maybe not substantive, but I just want to note it. In Section 8
oops, I missed it.
Yeah,
thank you.
Well, and in fact, I'm just looking
there at – there is no Section 8.
Yeah, I'm just looking at my numbering. Well, nobody
caught
that.
Yeah, it's under
7. So Section 7, so the last section observer should be Section 8.
Yes.
But further to Section 7, in the last paragraph in Section 7, she has added the sentence, the meeting in which a vote is initiated must be quorate. And I think I think she did that to make it consistent with Section 3.5, a quorum,
mm-hmm.
and for saying that a quorum must be present and a vote is initiated.
Yeah. I think it's consistent. I don't think we're being inconsistent by adding that. We're not creating ambiguity in any way, are we? I don't interpret it that we are.
No, I don't think so. I just wanted to point that out.
No, yeah, I'm glad you did. I'd like to go ahead and put that in. I'm just trying to read it from a different perspective where, okay, we put that in, now we've created some new ambiguity to this whole concept of quorum. But I don't think we are. Wolf, you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Okay, so, all right, now we've got one document again, right, Julie?
Yes, well, we will shortly.
Yeah, we will shortly. Okay, so next steps. I'm trying to move a little quick here because I know Wolf's got a hard stop. Okay, so next steps. Let's get the clean version, Julie, if you can today. I did promise on your behalf that we would send it off to we'll send it off to council. Okay. What we'll need is what do we need? We need a clean version. And I suppose why don't you take and how are you going to do a red line version?
Well, I wasn't sure because Chuck for one.
Yeah.
He wants just a clean version.
He just wants a clean version sent to the council?
That's what I read.
That's all he asked for, right?
That's what I read.
Okay, let's go ahead and do that. Let's follow exactly what he said. Let's send only a clean version, and if the council wants to ask us for red line versions, we'll handle it as the request comes in.
Right. I mean, I'll work on a red line version.
Yeah.
It's just going to take a little bit more time because I have to double back on all the changes and bring them into that red line version, but we can do a clean one more quickly. And I was also going to suggest something, too, and Rob, maybe you want to chime in on this as well. Right now I have... I don't have live links to the bylaws, but what I had thought to do was to include in these procedures as an appendix the bylaw sections that we're referencing, that is, here, and to insert in this document live links to those sections of the bylaws so that when someone gets to, where that phrase is, it's, see this part of the bylaws and they click on it, they're going to go to the appendix and see that bit of text, and then they'll be able to go back. I have to work out exactly how that will occur. But I think I can do that quickly enough to still be able to include that in the document for Chuck for the council today. But before I initiate that work, I just wanted to check and see if that would be useful.
I don't think that's necessary for this purpose.
Okay.
As you know, Julie, you and I have had discussions in the past. We built this on the previous version of the operating rules and procedures. I think it reads quite awkwardly to have all these inserts, but I think it's ultimately the most effective way to keep everybody apprised and clear as to where certain things are. So I think that will be very helpful in the final version, but in terms of just evaluating the existing operating procedures, I don't think it's necessary, but that's just me.
Okay, Ray, what do you think? Is that okay, do you think?
Yeah, I think for today's purpose, I agree. We can leave it out for now. I think later it will be more efficient. I think Rob said it eloquently. It's having all these inserts is not the optimal way, but it's the most efficient way we have to work with right now. So
thank you. I don't want to do any more work than I have to. Let me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thanks for offering.
Okay. Now, thank you very much. I have to leave right now.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Anything left for the record is just going to be housekeeping now, Wolf, okay?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
All right. Now, Julie, will you be posting we've kind of gotten away from our wiki page. I don't know if anybody out there in the world is looking at it or trying to follow along.
I'll put it up, Ray.
You'll put it up, and can you give a little brief paragraph explanation, too, that, okay, this is the version that has been sent to the council for their review, whatever.
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that.
Just something real brief.
I'll indicate that it's been reviewed by the OSC and the version to be sent to the council, et cetera.
Thank you. That would be good. All right. Now, what I was going to say to the rest of the work team members, but unfortunately they're not on, is we would, I suppose, technically have a call scheduled for the 23rd. We've been going now, I think, 5 or 6 straight weeks now with weekly calls. I was going to give the team a break, if you will, but I'll handle that by email. So with that said, I'm going to ask the meeting to be adjourned and end the recording. Unless there are any objections from the ICANN participants.
Thank you very much, Ray.
Thank you. Thank you, Rob, all the assistants and to Julie. So
I'll get this Ray to you shortly, probably in the next hour.
Very good.
Hey, Ray, this probably feels very anticlimactic to you, but this is a significant conclusion here. You guys have done some tremendous work, and... Mm-hmm. You know, while everyone sort of just dropped off at the end, I think, tremendous thanks for your leadership and exercise of working this through. It's been a real slog, and you guys have done a great job.
Well, thank you very much. And I kind of take that same tack. You know, if there's not a lot of dissension and arguing and disagreement going on, so everybody feels they can drop off and move on to more important things, that means we did something right. So very good. It's very good, folks. And thanks for the support.
Oh, thank you, Ray. Great job.
Okay.
All right,
thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay.